episode of Just a Few Miles Down the Road, which allowed me to be able to get you in while you're in and out, right? You were like in Costa Rica a couple of days. He was in Costa Rica just until like a few days ago, I think leaving tomorrow again or so, in the next couple of days somewhere else. But we were able to get him in today. And this is Richard Wilson. Now, Richard Wilson is the founder of the Family Office Club. And if you don't know what a family office is, a family office is basically, and he'll explain it, but it's basically a place where the super rich, like the billionaires and the centimillionaires, they don't give their money to Joe Doe down the road financial planner to invest their money. They typically like to have control, and they basically hire a few people and have them invest their own money as their own family investment offers. Is that about right?
Yep.
Right. So Richard has put together a family office club with lots of members. They have a huge network. They have over 12 million followers on social media. And he's going to talk to us today about, well, how the billionaires and centibillionaires, how they tick, how they operate, who they are, how they invest. And I think that is really, really crucial for us, because so many of you guys talked about, you want to subdivide, you want to develop, you want to entitle. Well, usually when you do that, it comes with some financial investment. Particularly then afterwards, perhaps you take it the next step and not just entitle and sell the paper then to somebody else, but actually take the thing and then would perhaps even go into the development space. Well, at that point, you might need some financial partners and you might need some investors. Well, what better to know than have an expert here that knows, that works with the richest people in the world and knows exactly how they operate, what they look like, what they look for, and how they take. With that said, a big round of applause for Richard Wilson.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. Appreciate being here. How many people here are an entrepreneur? You see it? So most people. So you don't become wealthy by going to your wealthiest down the street and say, diversify me to the extreme. Everyone should have some diversification of their net worth and some part of their portfolio. But when you talk about family offices, it just means people who have won in the game of capitalism. You can say, oh, this person got really lucky. This person got a little bit lucky. This person created all their own good luck. But a family office is really just serving the super successful entrepreneurs that become worth at least 7, 10 million, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. And just like you, you probably can't imagine working for 30 years. And once you get to some certain level of net worth, you say, okay, let me get to a wealth advisor. Probably don't mess it all up. Just be hands off and sit on the beach. You get bored. You wouldn't trust they wouldn't mess it up after 30 years of grinding, right? So the whole family office industry is really just all about wealth creators, entrepreneurs, and how someone just like you wants to manage their money in a really smart way. And that can include public markets, diversification, but it also includes other things, which is why you're here in the room. And it's why Jack's gotten 4,500 land deals done over time. I think I saw on social media the other day. Right? He wouldn't have gotten those deals done unless smart entrepreneurs knew they need to stay in some control of their destiny, because that's how you got to where you are today, is by taking control of your destiny, right? So that's the family office industry. We do work with billionaires. We do work with lots of 100 million plus over families, but we also work with a lot of angel investors, private investors, people who work $3, $5, $10, $15, $20 million. But what I found is that you can learn a lot from anyone in the world. You can learn a lot from anyone who's running a business that does seven figures or more. It doesn't have to be $10 million a year. But you can also learn a ton from those who are worth tens or hundreds or billions of dollars. They don't stop doing what worked. They don't stop doing what got them there. They keep doing the things that made them successful, right? So that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to go through 60 slides in about 60 minutes. We're going to have like 15 minutes for questions at any time during the talk. Just raise your hand. We can make this interactive. It's a small room. We don't get through everything. We already gave Jack access to the slides, so he can send to all of you. If you want to take pictures of anything, I don't care, but you will get access to all the slides. So there'll be one or two slides that are very detailed. I'm not going to bore you by reading off a super detailed slide, because you'll have access to them. A centimillionaire simply means someone who's worth 100 million plus. Before I forget, at the back, I did bring about 35 books, and half of them are my book on capital raising. The other half is my book on centimillionaires. We published 13 books the last 17 years and put out a lot of thought leadership. That's really how we have been growing the business. I own the whole business. We don't have any big brother partner, great debt on the business, et cetera. And when I started it, I was 25 years old. People still look at me like I'm a kid now at 41 years old. But I've been doing it for 17 years. But at the beginning, we had to do a ton of thought leadership to be taken even halfway seriously. because the wealth management space, the investment space is full of people who are not in their 20s in terms of running events or a community, right? So that's a little bit about our history. This is my team. One of our board members and investors is Joe Williams, a co-founder of Keller Williams Realty. So the largest real estate brokerage firm in the world. We've got 25 people on the team inside of our company. This is my home team. I've got my wife here. These are my three daughters. They're 7, 9, and 11 years old. Went to Croatia this summer. This is them working out with me at the gym, my two youngest ones. So I always have a lot of fun doing family stuff. I like doing outdoor adventure trips as well. This is us on the West Coast Trail. There's 130 ladders and bridges, some of them 30 stories tall, series of ladders going up the ocean cliffs up and down in Vancouver Island. So I do two backpacking trips with my guy friends each year, a couple big trips with my wife each year, and we take my whole family on ideally 2 to 4 big trips per year that are not just going somewhere small. This is us at Everest Base Camp on my birthday last year. This was 11 months ago. Made it all the way to Everest Base Camp, went to the Kumbo Ice Fall, and I got altitude sickness, and there were blizzards. I couldn't get helicoptered out, so it was in a 7-degree lodge the whole night. That wasn't too fun, but it was still the most fun trip of my life. And it was partially going there that led me to believe to relocate my whole family to Hawaii. And on June 4th, we're moving to Oahu this year. And we figure, I only live once, so worst case, we move out of Hawaii in a year or two. But I like surfing, trail running, and being outside. So Space Camp. So my wife and I do the rim to rim to rim here in the Grand Canyon. It was 23 hours. It took us 45 miles, 11,000 feet elevation gain. We like doing just fun stuff like that, just being outside. It's Havasupai Falls. I got halfway down this cliff, thought I was going to die. I'm like, wife, I'm not doing this. I'm going back. I couldn't even see where I was putting my feet. And I looked up and there's already three more people coming down. I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to keep going. I'm a big believer that if you are average, first of all, you didn't make it in this room. So you don't need to be told this. But the less average you are in more ways, probably the better. Average means you're a credit card debt, you're not happy, you feel like you're in a treadmill every day, not doing too many exciting things. For David Goggins, he was 300 pounds. He was a bug exterminator. And they saw Navy SEALs on TV and said, oh, I want to do that. And they laughed him out of the recruitment office and said, you can lose 90 pounds if people want to apply. People want to do the tryouts for it. So he lost that 90 pounds in 9 months. He became a Navy SEAL. And now he holds world records for doing 4,000 pull-ups in a day. He sold millions of copies of his books. And he's got a great sense of humor, but also like really disciplined work ethic to create something big out of yourself and see what you're really possible of, what you're capable of doing. None of you want an average event today. None of you want an average talk. So I'll try to keep you from falling asleep if I can. My brother went to Orange Theory and he did every workout they did in a day, 10 workouts in a row. He posted it to the Orange Theory fitness page. It wasn't in the New York Times. It wasn't a random Reddit thread. It wasn't just on Google. It was literally on a page for a fitness company. And all the comments were negative. They were all like, why would they allow you to do that? That's not legal. That's against the terms of the club. You're going to hurt yourself. Someone's going to try to do that and have a stroke. This is bad, blah, blah, blah. This totally trashing them. They're like, guys, we should be ripping on the people that can't even stand at Disneyland but are drinking Coca-Cola the size of a gallon of milk. This is Orange Theory fitness page. Why are they ripping on the person who worked out hard? They should require every Orange Theory member to work out 10 hours once a year. You know, it's like, so my point is that in modern society, people want you to be average. They want you not to excel, try this or that. Dan Kennedy says that if you're not pissing someone off by breakfast every day, you're not doing anything. You can write a book on how to save the children and someone else will get mad that you're overshadowing their nonprofit, or they'll catch a spelling mistake and try to find out how bad it is, right? So being non-average, doing things that are different, you're not always going to have everyone around you supporting that or saying good things about it. So you have to just know that. At this event and any other event you go to the rest of your life, obviously, I don't know what legal structures you have, what, you know, pretty sure you're, you know, what country you're in, but there's a whole bunch of things that might pertain to you. So obviously talk to your legal counsel before you go out and do a bunch of things you hear about in this presentation or others. Due diligence on anything you hear about. We show these slides at my event. We just hosted a 700-person event last week. So we show this just to make sure you always do due diligence and don't just go into something because they're somebody's friend or someone else went into it that you know. Like Jack said, Family Office Club is our brand. These are some of the books that we've cut out. We have hosted 275 events over 17 years. Close over $500 million of deals. Other stuff we already went over. Essentially, we're doing a family office club through this community. And we decided that the wealthiest families focus. And so we want to focus on growing our investor club and also focusing in the operating business niche only on medical and dental practices. So we work on multi-location practices, not medical devices, not health tech, not a number of other things like pharma. We like low-risk deals, so already profitable 2 to 5, 2 to 20 location medical and dental practices. So we just help them scale, help them capitalize, and we delay their sale of the private equity. And on the real estate side, our clients have interest in a number of areas. Honestly, land is not talked about enough. We see some areas talked about quite a lot, but land is not one of them. So it's just a little bit on our organization. This is one of the two books I brought here today. Some of the insights we provide here today are from things we're doing in our portfolio, but none of them are theories. They're all things that we have done. If it's otherwise, then it's a direct quote from a billionaire that I'm pretty sure is true. And then you'll see why that is. To start out with, I wanted to provide a few things that help you with raising capital. And then a lot of the presentation today is going to be about the mindset, the mental models, and the strategies of the ultra wealthy families so that you can both understand them better, to work with them, close them, partner with them, but also grow your own balance sheet, you know, twice as fast, hopefully. I hope that we get at least one $100,000 idea written down on your sheet from my presentation. If not several, that's the goal of many of these slides. But these first couple of slides will be directly related to how to raise capital, because Jack said there's an interest in maybe figuring out how to work with ultra wealthy families more. So first of all, the more of a class act human being you can be, the better. The best sales pitch you can make is how you've led your life the last 10 years. Have you been married 6 times in the last 10 years? You know, have you done this in your community? Have you added value in this other way? Have you built a track record? And there's a lot of little things I take away from watching people speak or reading their books that I try to ingrain in myself and become more like. Thinking, being very thoughtful before you take actions. Jeff Hoffman, we just did a fireside chat with him. He's a billionaire who created the airport check-in kiosk and was a startup investor in Booking.com and Priceline.com. He's super thoughtful about how he treats his employees, figuring out what's important for them, and then making a company goal so that they'll buy a house for somebody's mom who's been in the trailer park her whole life, but he'll buy that house for their mom once the company hits some huge goal, and then they're in it together to like change their life and their mom's life. Bruce Lee has a quote, calm is a superpower. I think that's something that is good for a lot of us to review, just to give you a more thoughtful outlook on life, et cetera. A lot of the stuff I don't need to read out, I think I know what I mean, but being both institutional quality and being a class act human being is what's going to attract the highest quality investors to you. Having a Gmail address shows that you didn't even invest $8 at GoDaddy.com and a domain name and a professional email address. So why should someone even invest 0.1 second of their life and look at what you're doing? If you don't take what you're doing seriously, why should they take what you're doing seriously? Their time is worth more than $8 even for a second of their time, right? So how do you be institutional quality? What does that mean if you've never heard of that before? Well, when you're raising capital, if you're ever going to get a check from someone for $5 or $10 million or more, it starts giving the world institutional capital. You're dealing with a family that's worth $100 million plus, or an insurance plan or a pension fund or a big wealth management group. So it often means following up and being politely patient for a response. It often means being polished, being understanding, turning a no into a yes. We'll talk about some ways to turn a no into a yes pretty soon here. It means making it so when someone looks at it, they can see that somebody cares about this company and this is not their first rodeo. This is not some startup that has no idea what they're doing. This is something that is professional and well put together. Many times it means looking at all the competitors in a little niche industry and saying, okay, out of all the other people that are doing storage or land or medical practices, what is the status quo? Does it look at least as good as that, if not better? And does a person get emotionally upset and stressed out when you say no, or we don't have time for a call this week, I'll follow up next month? And then you'd be surprised how many people say like, oh, well, I met you at the event. You said you'd follow up with me and you've been ignoring my emails for 2 weeks. It's like, it's not going to help the situation by getting mad at the person. They're just very busy and no one owes you a response to your email or phone call unless they're your partner and have said, I'm going to dedicate this much time to you as a board member. All these people get hundreds or thousands of emails per day or per week. So it has to be that much better than everything else coming in. And so the very base level is it has to look and feel at the institutional quality. So that's really important. This isn't horrible, but this looks much more institutional quality. It's a company we helped rebrand and we sold it to a billionaire who owns a bank. We're the number 2 investor in that company. We also rebranded this company You don't know what the company does. So it's called dynamic development. They develop land. They develop commercial real estate. They do business development. I don't know. I do know that they like clip art related logos, but we redid it and made it more professionalized. So you know that they do CRE construction management. So you have some idea of what they do. The worst brands in the world, you have no idea what they do. And they might even drive people away because it looks so horrible, or the brand doesn't exist, or it's purple font and PowerPoint slanted, right? So it is not hard to make something look like this. The biggest cheat code I have to doing that is just go to Adobe Photo Stock, type in the industry logo, the industry, the word symbol, look through hundreds of images related to your industry. Don't have it look like everyone else with the cookie cutter house image. And then choose the best one and then buy that stock image and then have some graphic designer just tweak it for $5 or $10 on Fiverr. And you can have a professional looking logo like this without spending thousands of dollars on branding. But being thoughtful about the name is really important. If your name is Wilson Capital, no one cares unless they already know you.
Yeah.
Right. So it has to say kind of what you're doing, like what you're trying to do. That's why our medical practice division is called Medical Clinic Capital. That's why our interview series where we're interviewing 100 billionaires publicly is just simply billionaires.com. So there's no confusion around what you do and you have some hint at it versus something like dynamic development. So that's super important. The other thing related to raising capital that can make you millions of dollars or lose you millions of dollars is the structure of the deal. I ran our investor club for 8 or 9 years before I started paying a ton of attention to this. And now I've got examples of dozens of deals that we have closed that people told me, no, go away. We're never going to do this deal with you. It's not for sale. And then I offer them a structure that they hadn't considered before. And they say, oh, we'll do that deal. The same day they told me to go away and I was wasting my time with them, they told me we'll do that deal because of the structure of the deal. So we own more single word domain names in the medical space than anyone else, including dermatologist.com, parasitologist.com, obstetricians.com, et cetera. And I invested couple hundred thousand dollars in that, went to one investor. And I told that investor, well, how about this? My money's already in. You put in your money. And when we sell the domain names or monetize them and contributing them to medical practices that we could scale, you get all of your money out first. Then I get my money out. And then we're pro rata. So we take a big haircut. I take all the haircut. And I'm bald. He gets all his money out. Right. So that's an example of structure. Another one was with billionaires.com. For 12 years, I followed up every 3 to 4 months for 12 years till they finally sold it to me. And it was using a creative structure that we were able to get that done. And we just had to close in 10 days and move fast. So that was really important as well. So I don't have time to go over all the different examples of having a great deal structure. To think about, are you able to get diluted? Are they able to get diluted? Is there collateral behind the deal? So they're sure that they're not going to lose their shirt. Is there transparency? Is there optionality? Do you get the cash flow or do they get the cash flow? Can you use a gross revenue royalty? Is it first money in, last money out? How do you make it so you win when they win and you don't win before they win? If you're looking to raise capital, you should win together. And people don't mind having you get paid handsomely, but you should get paid handsomely after they've gotten their principal off the table, probably. Like all these things. We've done a 6-hour workshop just on deal structures, and we're talking here for 90 seconds about it. So there's no way to go over all of it, but you get the idea. If you haven't gone down those rabbit holes, you'll close twice as many deals if you become an expert at navigating deal structures. There's probably number one overlooked element in terms of getting deals done and raising capital. If you act like a class act human being, you look and feel institutional quality, you focus on a small niche and you have expertise and you add value first and build a genuine relationship and the deal is structured right, right there is like half what you need to raise a lot of capital in my experience. Most people are doing something that looks like everybody else. The branding, that means nothing, some Greek god capital. No one ever asks what that Greek god is, except for your spouse, maybe. And then they are not using creative structures. You go out to the world and say, I have a land fund like a robot. You want to be an LP. Some people don't do funds. They want to invest direct. Some people want to be creative, do co-GP or JV or have land to contribute in lieu of cash or want to source things for you as a co-GP. If you don't know how to navigate all that, then you're stuck with just a hammer. You have no screwdriver, you have no pliers, you have no tweezers. You need all these tools in your toolbox. Okay, so went over most of that already. Okay, so now I'm going to get into kind of my favorite part of the presentation, but the parts, these last like 7 or 8 slides there is really fundamentals of how to raise capital. And I've got just about enough books for everyone, I think, but the capital raising book gives you a 5-step system And it's a 100-page answer to how do I raise capital systematically? And this is how we have done it and built our whole company. And then this book was the first book ever written for 100 million plus net worth families. If you want to work with anyone who's worth over 20 or 30 million, they typically have the six challenges that people have if they're worth 100 million. And we run into these same six challenges just about every time I work with somebody. So it's really important to get those dialed in. And when you reach out to a family, knowing what we're talking about today, knowing structures, it's one of the best ways to add value first is to suggest something they could do to structure the scaling of their balance sheet faster. If you do that, they'll want to reply because it's in their best interest to reply to you. If you just pitch them, then they say, oh, do I want to meet to maybe invest those versus deal? I don't know. But do I want to meet to figure out how I can scale my company twice as fast while getting diluted less every time I open a new gas station or car wash or hotel? Yeah, maybe I do want to do that, right? So I want to make it in their best interest to reply to you, not in your best interest. I can carry your amazing pitch if you want to develop relationships. Any questions on that before I move on to the next session?
Questions.
Okay.
I just want to mention how pretty crucially important for each of service right there. Like that, a part of making sure the other party wins first is like literally at the gate. Like I can't stress that a lot. That's
99% of the world doesn't get that.
Right. Most of the world does not get that at all. The investor needs to win first. And it all comes down, you're basically just trying to build trust so someone can be high conviction that you are the right person to be a steward of some of their capital. And if it's structured so they have security, then that makes it go much better, right? What I tell investors all the time is you want to be sourcing deals first. You want to source deals exclusively, and you want to source deals at a better valuation than anyone else. And you don't get that by having bad positioning. You have to have good positioning in a niche area. And if you've done really well for yourself and you're an investor and you're going to have to negotiate deals, I don't know how many times we've asked, oh, well, is there any collateral like medical equipment, receivables, land, real estate assets that we could have as collateral added to this deal? And many times it was not structured in there, but as an investor, you ask and you can get collateral added to it. Now your downside is that you have a process of collecting on that collateral, right? So on the investor side, it's one of the most profitable questions that you can ask. You sleep better at night, but it's all about trust. It doesn't matter if you're in the market to join a mastermind like this, and you're like, I need to find another mastermind to really connect with other people. And you were going to fly somewhere for spring break with your kids this week and you go to the airport. And then while you're in the lounge, someone hears you on a phone call and you hang up and they say, hey, I run this mastermind. You know, let me tell you what it's about. See if you want to join. You're probably going to be like, oh, no, sorry. I got to catch my flight. I got to do these emails. Like, it's just out of context. It's a random pitch that you're not really open to random pitches in general. And wealthy investors are just as busy as any of us here in the room or more busy. And so the thing is, like, without the context of trust, you don't really want to hear a pitch usually. It's like, it's just noise. It's just someone trying to sell you something, right? All right. So this next section, we're going to talk about something that I think is worth millions of dollars and it's added millions of dollars to our company. And it's scientifically proven that whatever you consume, it changes the outputs in your brain. So they have shown through scientific studies that if you just read only highly liberal Democrat news for 2 years, and you only hang out with people who think like that, then you think more like that. If you hang out only with Republicans, only read what Trump says, then you think a little bit more like that, right? So all of us know that. Same goes with if you read everything on land or medical practices, you just absorb all that knowledge, you'll become much, much smarter on that, right? Or let's imagine that you only learn from people like Jack with the thousands of land deals, and then you study that. It's going to change your outputs. That's pretty common sense and pretty proven. But what I'm about to show you is very uncommon and rare for someone to do, but I think so obvious once you think about it. So if you wanted to learn how to play basketball, you could go and find a player at Duke who's really good, and you could get mentored by him. You could have a mentor your kid if he wants to play pro basketball one day, but he's only at the Duke level. He's not pro yet. There's rumor he might go pro. And there's a lot of college basketball people that they could learn from. Or you could learn from Jordan. Obviously, you'd rather learn from Jordan, right? Just like Kobe did, right? So I will shadow the very best and copy not only what they say, but their work ethic, their mindset, their mental models, their strategies, their literal movements, et cetera, right? So it's obvious you first should learn from Jordan until you run out of time with Jordan. Then maybe go to the Duke guys. We can't find any other pro athletes to study. But first, study the heck out of Jordan, right? So how many people here out of your whole life have read over 200 business books, do you think, in your life?
I'm not 200.
How about over 100 business books? Good amount. So how many people have read over 10 books that are written by a billionaire? Hey, five or six people, six, seven people. So my point is that a lot of us have read 50, 100, 200 business books, but most of us have not read more than 5 or 10 from a billionaire. We're mostly reading books by people who are really good at marketing their books. They're not really good at business compared to billionaires. So I tell you, run out of the Michael Jordans to get mentored by. Why would you read a book by anyone else unless it's in your little niche? So if I'm focused on medical practices, okay, I want to study the best of medical practices and the best in business. And then I get niche-specific mental models that I also can cross-pollinate that with all the ideas from billionaires. And I find most people don't do that. They go to the New York Times bestseller list, who is the best marketing machine to pump their book out on how you can work 4 hours a week or how you can do this, or, you know, it's all about atomic habits or about this or that. It's like all noise compared to first learning from the billionaires in my mind. I'm on a mission to read every book ever written by a billionaire. I've read 76 of them so far, and there's 240. These are worth over $100,000 each. These are the top 25 books written by billionaires that I've gone through so far. And you can get mentored directly from billionaires. Some of these people have only written one book their entire life, sharing what they've learned. And the ideas I get from these books are more powerful than anything I've learned at my own conferences, anything I've learned at anyone else's conferences, because it's concentrated wisdom directly from a billionaire. And it's not filtered. There's lots of books written on billionaires, but I don't want some non-billionaire's interpretation of a billionaire's life. I want the words that a billionaire decided to put down on paper and put out in the world, right? So I'm reading those. I think it's going to transform our business. We're also interviewing 100 billionaires publicly. So we have 40 of those interviews available at billionaires.com, including Mark Cuban, Tony Robbins, Tim Draper, Jeff Hoffman, Grant Cardone, many others. We just interviewed the youngest billionaire in India. He's 27 years old. I think that when we get to reading all 240 billionaire books, we're going to rank the top 48. Some people can just focus on those 48, not go through all 240. But also interviewing 100 billionaires, I think there's going to be things there that transform our business entirely. And we've already been able to scale from 1.2 million in social media to 12 million just the last couple of years using the strategies we learned from this. So this is a list of all 240 books. If anyone's super ambitious, you can have this QR code there. 110 of them are available on Audible. So you can study this for the next decade and never run out of new ideas coming directly from billionaires into your business on how to scale faster. All right. So one thing that's interesting is one of my mentors, Evan Pagan, he got to interview two billionaires on the same day. And what was interesting is that the commonalities between what Steve Jobs and Bill Gates both said. Steve Jobs said, oh, well, you know, because he said, how did you create Apple? How did you do such amazing things? And Steve said, well, a lot of things didn't go right. We made a lot of mistakes. We just kept the things that went right. And his ending comment was, you just really have to care. You have to care about the customer, care about the company. Bill Gates said the same thing at the start. He said, well, we made a lot of mistakes. We did a lot of things wrong. But once you have one product that's a flagship that works, like Microsoft Windows, then you just need good managing directors and the whole company can scale. So they had different second half of the answers. But the first half was they both made lots of mistakes. They're not flawless. Like, they're so genius. They know how to do everything at the beginning. Lots of people make mistakes. I mean, Richard Branson has over 300 companies and he does tens of billions a year of revenue. But one of his failures was Virgin Brides. He said he couldn't find any customers and they had to shut down. This book is one I recommend in this market, this economy, that is good to consider. Stupid book out joke. So Howard Marks is the author of The Most Important Thing. And as a multi-billion-dollar hedge fund creator, it's really timely advice for right now because people think the general opinion is the opposite of what you should usually do. You know, what's interesting is that Howard says that when people think that you'd probably be dumb to be investing right now, because everyone knows it's a bad time to invest, look in the market, it's going poorly. Whether or not you think that's the case right now, that's the better time to invest. And when everyone thinks you'd be a complete idiot to do anything because, oh, crypto is so toxic, you know, BlockFi just went under. Why would you do anything with crypto? It's like, well, then it's going to be at a discount. You know, anytime that it's not popular, it's like a discount. If it's super, super popular, you're paying way over the top premium. So something to keep in mind, Howard Marks said that the best deals he's done of his life were everyone around him thought he was doing something dumb, super risky. but the risk was reduced because everyone thought it was done. So it's hard to think about that, but also keep in mind that Warren Buffett says that the current and the flow of the river is more important than the quality of the swimmer. So you need to be on trend with what's inevitable long-term. And like Peter Thiel says, trying to predict the future and have conviction and the courage to go after something that hasn't happened yet, but you know is inevitable, but at the same time, not be swayed by that being unpopular. Gary Vaynerchuk says that if you're chasing the herd, you're never going to position yourself as number one. You have to position yourself years before the herd comes, and now you're positioned as number one in that niche. So all these ideas kind of connect and relate to each other. And there could be a lot of ideas we share with you here in this presentation. The idea isn't to go and try to use them all. It's like a food buffet, and you pick and choose what looks good to you right now. And you can save some of these ideas for later or just discard whatever you don't love. Tony Robbins is someone I interviewed about 6 months ago. You can listen to that interview. It's just 13 minutes long at billionaires.com. A couple of his big insights. Proximity is power, just like being in this room. So Tony says that he did one deal, and that one transaction made $400 million because he was in proximity of big financial players, and he was able to connect the dots and get it done. That's part of the reason why you're here in the room, right? But you could be mentally in proximity with 150 billionaires by reading these 240 books, right? You'd be thinking like them and more like them. Tony also said at $10 million a year in revenue, he was working harder than he does now at $10 billion a year in revenue because he was in operator mode. He was the one turning the crank and doing everything. But in owner mode, instead of operator mode, he is acting as kind of more of a chairman instead of CEO. So that's a level you want to get to over time is figure out. By the way, some strategic coach fans in here, including Jack and his wife. Yeah, I was in strategic coach for 5 years, and I love Dan Sullivan. He says there's two types of knowledge, specialized knowledge and worthless knowledge. That's why you're here. Specialized knowledge is what I'm trying to transfer over to you. That's what billionaires have. But also, there's a couple of books by Dan, like the ABC Method and the Unique Ability 2.0 Workbook. And he teaches to really focus on, you know, what is most of your value created? Get rid of the other 80% of stuff. And they do that every single year. So you're more and more focused on what you're exceptional at and passionate about, right? And that's what he's talking about by being an owner mode. Sam Zell had a book on the slide a couple slides ago that I'd highly recommend, Am I Being Too Subtle? It's a real estate multi-billionaire you get direct mentorship from in that book. And in that book, he says that he wants to be the chairman of everything and the CEO of nothing. That was his goal in life, right? Kind of half joking, but pretty serious. It's like, I want to architect it, be strategic, focus on what I'm passionate about. But the day-to-day management of every employee and KPI and everything, that constrains you to just one business at most, right? So a couple of quick takeaway slides. As David Rubenstein, founder of Carlyle. I've noticed that billionaires are masters of productivity. They can't become ultra successful without being so. So there's a whole series of things to look at. We just talked about Tony Robbins in owner mode. That Kunal Kumar, who just interviewed the youngest billionaire in India, he talked about only working on things that are exciting, can be really big, not working on things that are non-exponential. Rubenstein, his name is for always moving, always being hyper-responsive. He's the first to reply and email threads and guides the conversation and direction they go in. He gets back to everyone almost right away. And he's one of the most productive people alive today compared to people all around him. Peter Thiel talks about something called extreme focus. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. And Bezos talks about moving when you have 70% of the information in front of you. Never going to have 100%. So it's more costly to not take an action. And most actions are reversible. I moved to Hawaii. I don't like it. Okay, now I have a real estate asset in Hawaii and we'll rent it out. And then we won't be living in Hawaii. No big deal, right? Sit around thinking about it for years or regretting not moving there, it'd be a costly mistake. So making sure that the things you focus on are really worth it. Dr. Bharat Sanghani came to the US with $10 to his name. And now he's a multi-billionaire, and he only focuses on things he could grow to a $1 billion balance sheet or larger. So just hearing that, thinking about that, makes you think on a different scale, like what's scalable, what's going to be worth it, and not just create a little short-term gain. Another thing that I found by studying them is the scalability and seizing a window of time. Number three here, folks, only on big ideas, exponential ideas. One thing that I do every morning is I have a laminated one pager and I read it every day while I'm shaving. And it has my monthly, quarterly, annual goals. And then about 40 statements, like the one from Bruce Lee saying that calm is a superpower. only focus on exponential things. Don't take any meetings I don't want to take. Only focus on things I'm excited about. What I do matters more than how hard I work. But at the same time, I have pictures of 15 advisory board members or people I look up to and want to be like in some way. Dan Sullivan is one of them on there. But I also have people like Mark Wahlberg and Micah Jordan on that one pager. So while what I do is more important than how hard I work, what I found is that anyone who makes it to past 10 or 20 billion net worth, they not only work hard, they also work smart. And they also work hard on becoming smarter faster than other people. And one of the biggest commonalities among the billionaires is that they're voracious learners, whether that's through books or podcasts or newspapers or all the above. And so sucking in all the information on your niche possible is what's going to help you grow exponentially and not just in a linear fashion like most other people. Also, doing things that other people don't do by definition is needed if you don't want to be like everybody else. And you already know that. You're already an entrepreneur. Almost everyone raised their hand, right? You're not a cubicle jockey at a large corporation. And all of you could have been, right? Warren says that when you're getting lucky, make sure you get buckets out and not thimbles and take advantage of that. That's something I've seen several billionaires bring up, is that when you're in the right space at the right time, then you have to go big and seize that moment because you might only get a few of those moments every decade. Or even in your whole career. This example we already gave on Bitcoin. But another example is like during COVID, Marriott, MGM, Disney, they all went down by 90% value of the stock market. It was like, okay, this, at some point Marriott, Disney are going to get back to their previous highs probably. So it doesn't take like a stock trader or genius to know, okay, we have to have some courage at this point and go in on this. So if you want to scale your balance sheet, it requires something that's not only scalable, but really seizing a moment and making sure you take the best advantage of it. You don't get something by settling small. HX founder, he had one chance. He's written two books I've read. He had one chance to go to all the franchisees of Paychex and then unify them with a buyout offer. And everyone accepted unanimously. If he hadn't have, it would have been a mess. But he had to think big and go big or he's going to be stuck and he never would have scaled to where he was today if he did that. Cuban was offered $150 million for his company and he turned it down. He said, nope, we're going to the $1 billion mark. We're not going to sell for $150 million. Same with Arnold. He basically, after becoming Mr. Olympia, he said, I want to be a leading man and star in Hollywood films. And people offered him a role as a soldier or a security guard or a bouncer. And he said, forget that. I'm not doing that. I'm going to the leading role. And he was focused just on that, even though people said, you can't even speak English clearly. No one knows what you're saying. No one can pronounce your last name. Change your last name. And he ignored all of them and focused on it until he did that. Right. And so it's pretty amazing. When Elon took over Twitter, he said, I'm going to mess up a bunch of stuff, but that's okay. We're going to figure it out. We're going to get it going over time and do amazing things. And Tesla almost went out of business a couple times for big bets that he took. So, like Bezos says, some decisions are reversible. Obviously, you shouldn't do too many things in your life that is like you lose your whole company or you lose your net worth, you go bankrupt, it doesn't work out. Definitely don't encourage that type of thinking. But really aiming big and not settling for small when someone tries to buy out your company, totally, at least don't do a full buyout, right? And try to have your cake and eat it too and take a partial one. So obviously, by definition, you don't get to 50 or 100 million if you sell out at 5 billion if that's as big as your vision is. One other thing I've noticed is that while it's popular to talk about, hey, you should work less. You should only work 3 days a year or 3 days a week. You should only work, an hour a day, et cetera. There's only one billionaire who I have studied so far out of a couple hundred that said the whole way up, they just work smart and not hard. And I know that the founder of the Huffington Post likes to talk about making sure you take very balanced and don't work that hard. But she became a billionaire by grinding for 15 years and didn't sleep for several days so much that she fell and broke her jaw on a desk. I definitely don't encourage that, but it makes it less credible when someone who became a billionaire says, don't overwork yourself too hard, when for 15 years she did, and now she's a billionaire. And so the point is to like make it fun and exciting and don't have people on your team that are energy vampires. Don't work with bad partners. Don't work on things that are not exponential because the people who I listen to, when you hear their ideas in the books, they don't talk about how you have to put in a painful grind and it's all pain and it's all super hard work and it was all for the money. Someone commented yesterday on LinkedIn And they said, what is our society coming to? And the ultimate goal is to become a billionaire. And I replied like 30 seconds later saying, I've never met a single person, including billionaires, where their number one mission in life was just the money, money, money. It's all about becoming a billionaire. It's not like their number one mission in life. It's just a scarecrow tactic by people who want to, you know, dismiss capitalism altogether. It seems we have the people in society that know more these days. But it's an exciting adventure and it's fun to do this thing. It's not just hard work. But to other people, it's like, oh, why are you working so hard? Oh, all they do is work. But to them, it's exciting and they don't have to defend themselves. Other people can judge them and they'll have a high quality life because they're willing to work hard. And that's what Arnold talks about in his book. I'm reading Arnold's book called Be Useful. And I read it to my kids each night. We read 5 to 10 pages. And in that book, he talks about putting in the reps and putting in the hard work and putting in what's needed to get things done and also having a really big vision. And in my experience, you don't get there without the work ethic. So this was a great book, built from scratch for the founders of Home Depot. But they're a good example of how it's an exciting adventure and not just hard work. This concept we're going to talk about on these next two pages is something that's made us millions of dollars. It continues to help us. And it's just a topic that you could sit in a room for hours or have a full day event just on this topic. In fact, we might do that one day. And the more I think on this, the more that our company scales more exponentially. And I got this idea from a book called Mastering the Rockefeller Habits. And the idea is to acquire strategic choke points. So after you have a choke point, it makes everyone else's lives a little bit harder trying to compete against you. It makes people want to work with you more. It makes you grow faster, usually lowers your costs or increases your distribution. And I've shared this graphic for the last 12 years while presenting this idea, but more and more people recognize this graphic these days because of the disputes in the Middle East. And right here controls 25% of the global oil trade. And so every major country has military bases right here, because that is a strategic choke point. If you control that, you control a lot of energy flow around the world, just like Panama Canal. And so what you want to do in your business is figure out what one thing would be a domino to make everything else go easier. Is your problem getting deal flow? Is your problem talent? Is your problem the best deals get eaten up first by others? Well, what if, like, let's say you're in the mobile home park space. Maybe nationally, there's 5 mobile home park breakers that are the most well-known nationally. Could you go and buy 1% or 5% of their business? Could you go to them and say, hey, I want a 90-minute look at your deals before you reach out to your list? Your commissions are normally, you know, 5% or 6% that you're splitting with someone else. And maybe you get 4% or 5% if you do both sides of the transaction as a broker yourself. We'll give you 7%. But we want a 90-minute look before it goes out to your list, or we'll give you 8%, and we're going to eat up your best deals, and we'll make you a co-GP on that deal, and we'll do this for you, et cetera, and to get deals first. That's just one of hundreds of examples of a strategic choke point. Another example is we have the only book, you know, written with the word centimillionaire in the name of it. We wrote the first book with the word single family office in the name of it. We're the only ones that own billionaires.com. We have more speakers on stage for family office events than anyone else. We see more deal flow, create more relationships. We get smarter at each event. We're trying to do a number of things that help us in the little sandboxes that we're carving out for ourselves that make it so everything else gets easier for us instead of harder. And so looking at things like, what's your biggest expense? For us hosting big events, 1,000 people, you know, we'll spend $1 million to host a big, large conference, and the hotel cost is a whole bunch of that, a couple $100,000. So eventually, we want to have venues in these key cities or partners that co-host events with us, and if they get exposure on stage at our event, maybe they're out $30,000 for their food costs and some staffing costs, but now they got exposure to this huge investment event, which is strategic because they own a bunch of hotels. We don't have that place quite yet. We do for our small masterminds, not for our big summits. So that would be a big choke point. Now we could double the number of events we have each year and still only spend half our competition bid on half the amount of events, right? So ideally, choke points, once you secure them, it's very hard to displace you. There's a nonprofit in your town and you could lead that nonprofit and it's full of relationships that lead to you raising capital. Then you being the volunteer leader and just doing an amazing job means unless you mess up or get tired of it, if people don't like you, then that's like a choke point. You're secured that leadership role. Another could be going to IPO Tiger 21 or a big investment conference and negotiating a exclusive sponsorship and say, I want to be the only land development person allowed to sponsor this conference. What do you normally pay? Can it be exclusive? It might say yes. It might say to be exclusive, you need to pay 50% extra. And then you can be the only land person who's allowed to sponsor that event in your city and do that with five different events in your city. Those would be choke points. Whereas you maybe don't own the IP forever. In some cases you do, like billionaires.com, but it might just be a position that's pretty hard to displace you in. So when we got started, we bought familyoffices.com. We built that up. When he wrote the book on capital raising, bought capitalraising.com. We got a LinkedIn. We had an offline networking group. We had another software platform. We put it on LinkedIn. We became the largest registered investor group with family offices globally. That helped us with having best-selling books done through Wiley and Bloomberg and then self-publishing our books. That helped us grow. It was a form of a choke point. We then had 42 LinkedIn groups. We now have 84 different LinkedIn networking groups, but we became the number one on LinkedIn for investment groups. And that's where about 95 or 93% of our 12 million followers are, is LinkedIn. We have the number one conference series in the industry, meaning like the most number of conferences or speakers on stage. All of this gave us more credibility. By having this, it helped us get this. By having a best-selling book, it helped us get credibility online and at our events. By having great speakers at our events, it helped us write our 10th book. And then we acquired assets like commercialrealestate.com, billionaires.com, et cetera. We also acquired the largest social media asset in the dental industry. So we have 375,000 members there. So these are, each one of these helped the other one. Each one of them grew a credibility. Each one helps us create thought leadership and spread thought leadership, create more relationships with investors, get more deal flow. And figuring out how to apply this template to your business can really help, because otherwise you say something like, oh, I want to be number one in stem cell investments in the state of Texas. Okay, great. But someone could wake up tomorrow who's 19 years old, has no experience, say the exact same thing and put the same thing on their business card, same thing on their website. What you want to do is have things that no one else can say unless there's complete fraud and you're just making it up. It's, you know, 4,500 land deals that Jack's done, or us spending $25 million to host 275 events over 17 years. And other people can't say that. So it helps you bring in clients. And I equate it to, if you have a sandbox, just like a kid's sandbox, any two-year-old with 2 years of experience in the industry can just wander in. And there's no walls to it. But if you build up the walls to it, you have the number one book, the number one website, the number one networking group, you're in these leadership positions, you've got this track record, like, people are going to look at it and say, oh, I don't want to compete directly with Jody, like what she's done. Let's either partner with Jody or let's go in this other niche that's adjacent and not focused on Scottsdale land or whatever it may be, right? So that's really important, because entering a crowded space, almost nothing's more painful in business if you've done the same thing as everyone else. And it's really tough. A lot of us have learned that the hard way. If there are any questions on this, choke points, or the other 25 slides I just blew through pretty quickly, I want to make sure I get to as much as possible. But any questions from the audience? So,
choke point isn't necessarily something that's bad, right? It's just recognizing this might be where we're really good at something, or it can build up on it, like you're saying.
Right. Yeah. The question is, a choke point's not necessarily something bad. It could be something you could build up, and just recognizing that. And it's usually bad for your competitors once you have one, but it could be fixing the most painful parts of your business. Or if you had it, your growth would be inevitable, or your success would be much faster. And so it's usually speeding up your acquisition of deal flow, capital, distributing what you're doing somehow, or reducing something which is a major burden or cost to your business. Something that's like, oh man, we could just figure out this talent issue, or we could just get this figured out, everything would be so much easier. And so those are examples of choke points. But yeah, it could be not fixing something bad. It could be something that's just very exciting. Right? Does anyone want to try to apply this to their business on something that they're having a challenge with, or is it pretty obvious to make sense?
It seems.
Very cool. Yeah. No problem. So what I found is that by studying these people, I think there's like a perception by some people that, oh, well, they have all the capital in the world, or they got lucky one time. So now I'm like, who cares what they do now? Because like they already made it. So it's not super relevant. What I found is not that they have a lot of capital. It's that at a base level, they have got to know themselves well to not spend their time on little things that are operator mode. They have to get out of that, know themselves, know what they're amazing at, right? But they also don't have patience for non-excellence around them. And that means not having bad team members. All of us have hung on to a team member for years longer than you wanted to, because some part of your brain was like, ah, it's going to be a hassle to replace them. And maybe they're B-minus, C-plus, or maybe they kind of hurt our culture a bit, but, you know, they've been in that role for 12 years or 3 years. Let's just leave them there for now, put our energy elsewhere. So they know themselves well. They have great teams, great joint venture partners. They usually have mini business models. So if something isn't profitable, then they just get rid of it. They don't have bad partners. They'll just get rid of it. They don't have patience for it. Some businesses will just be very strategic and they get them information, deal flow. It's a choke point. Just having that business itself could be deal flow, like a land brokerage company or something. But the point is that they don't have an advantage just on one level. They have an advantage on themselves, their employees, their business model, their joint venture, their margins, their distribution channels, their credibility. And it's all that creates exponential return. It's not just a linear math equation. And so it's really stacking everything we're talking about today, as many of those things as possible, because most people don't have strategic choke points in their business. Most people don't take the time to even read 20 books written by billionaires or reading other pop books, you know, that are super popular. And go and say, oh, have you read this one? Have you read Dr. Atiyah's book? Have you read this other book, etc.? This next section here we're going to talk about is extreme focus. I think as you grow a business, every year you have to get better at a number of things. One is controlling your focus and the inputs that come in. One of them is learning how to say no faster and easier, more and more often. Because you can be pretty good at saying no to things. Then you get busier because you're more successful. Even if you have the same amount of free time, there's more opportunities coming at you. So you have to get better at saying no. But also, you're going to have less time on your hands because now you have 10 employees instead of 5 employees. So you have to get much, much better at saying no over time. And Peter Thiel says, extreme focus is a superpower. And that's a direct quote from one of the most successful tech billionaires there is. But extreme focus is not normal. It's not easy. And if you want to make everyone happy in life, sell ice cream. But even then, someone's going to complain that your ice cream melted or it's too salty, something, right? So the point is that the goal isn't to make every single person you come in contact with happy. And if you're like me, you have a hard time saying no to people sometimes. You're trying to keep customers happy, trying to keep partners happy, trying to keep employees happy. Like, what's the point? Probably just trying to do that. So that's just something important to keep in mind. One thing I do each morning besides reading that laminated one pager is watch like a YouTube short from David Goggins. And one of his recently, you know, he said, oh yeah, people ask like, hey Goggins, how do you work so hard every day? How do you do that? It seems like impossible. You're like a robot and all that. He's like, no, some days I don't feel like working out. So I wake up and I'm like, man, felt a little tired, sore, got this knee injury I'm dealing with, had surgery last month. Yeah. Did a 3-hour workout yesterday. And he's like, maybe I won't work out today. Maybe I'll skip it. Maybe I should just be like everyone else and be normal. Maybe I'll just be like normal and average. And then he thinks himself, says, no, F that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be normal. You know, and for you, applying this to a business person's life, the equivalent is for you, it might be putting out thought leadership. It might be going out and systematically meeting with 10 joint venture partners every month or quarter. Or we're here, we're not trying to qualify for Navy SEALs. We're not trying to make a pull-up world record. We all should be healthy and invest in our health, of course. But it doesn't mean working out for 3 hours a day. It means making sure that you're putting in the reps that Arnold talks about or Goggins talks about, but in your business, in strategic moves, and upgrading your brain and your mental models and your strategies by being in rooms like this, right? So taking that mindset from a billionaire or from a Goggins, but applying it to what's the race that you're racing? What's the monopoly game you set up for yourself? And how do you know if you're winning that game? And how do you do the work that other people aren't willing to do, like Goggins did, but interpret that for your business, right? We're not trying to out-pull up Goggins here. That's not why we're in this room, right? So you should take in that and not read it at face level on how to be the fittest human being in the world, but the fittest in your industry and the most competitive in your industry is super important. Right. And that's one common thing is that you need to be able to do things that others don't want to do. They don't have time to do. They don't have the passion to do it. Jim Collins showed us the 3 circle Venn diagram of what you've got the DNA to be good at, you're passionate about, and you can make a lot of money at. And if you do things that just make you a lot of money, then someone's going to eat your lunch who's passionate about it. Every time I fly first class, and usually when I fly at all. I'm the only person working. Maybe there's one other person with a laptop out. Everyone else is sleeping or streaming something on Hulu. I guess they're all just ridiculously efficient at their time and very successful. But I'm eating some of their lunches because I'm passionate. I'm excited about what we're doing. So we get things done, structure the next deal, launch the next product, get something done, right? So the point is that you can't do things you're passionate about that don't make you money. You have to do something you're naturally good at. You have to really find the connection of all those things, or you will not want to have extreme focus. And in your mind, maybe you don't think it's even possible to achieve that vision that you have for yourself, or you don't have a clear vision. But when I started, I wanted to be number one on family offices. And I didn't have a super clear definition for what that would be, but in terms of books, websites, website visitors, et cetera. And now we have more thought leadership than all the other family office organizations globally combined because of that work ethic. And now it's after 17 years and now 2 years into billionaires.com. And I don't know what's going to happen when we make billionaires.com the number one resource globally for billionaire balance sheet scaling strategies for anyone that wants to create wealth. But I'm pretty sure a lot of good stuff will happen. We'll learn from billionaires, we'll connect with some of them. And so I have the passion to do that even without knowing what the result would be, but it's only going to be good results. There's no way it's going to be bad. Even if no one on planet Earth cares, like, I know I'll learn some stuff, right? So that's the type of mindset that has helped us become successful. This one I briefly touched on, get rid of the bad employees, the mediocre, figure out what's the worst part about running a business for you? You know, can you go into owner mode and just hire someone to do that part? Life's too short to do something that is just frustrating every day, right? That just makes you stress out, lose sleep at night, et cetera. Energy vampires in your life of any type, you just need to get out of there. Any negative news, negative friends, any negative inputs in your life, most of those can be strategically reduced short or medium term. So I'd aggressively remove those. Usually it's like 2% of your life is creating like half of your stress. It was like a few clients. They're like always annoying. Yeah, you make money off of them, but you make money off your other clients too. So forget them. Let them go annoy your competitors so they can be slowed down by it. Right? So I think that's really important. It comes up often with billionaires. Steve Jobs defines extreme focus as doing something that has such a high priority and focus for you. It could be so huge for you, like launching the iPhone, that there's other things that you could do, and you know for sure they would make you money, and you know for sure they'd be profitable. Your margins would be amazing, and it would also be exciting, but it's going to distract 5 or 10% from your big goal that you have. So one of my one-liners is that I say no to almost everything, and I say no to things that I know would make me money. And sometimes I show that people and say, why would you say no to things that you know would make you money? So as an entrepreneur, we all had to go in startup mode and you're trying like 5 different experiments at once in each part of your business and figuring out what's going to work and make a whole bunch of pitches. And as you scale, you have to continue to get good at saying no. And probably where you're at right now already is that you're saying no all the time to things that could make you money, client that can make you money, new business vision that can make you money. But it takes away the vision of executing on something that could be huge. Arnold, in his documentary, which is pure gold. If you haven't watched Arnold's documentary on Netflix, I don't care if you don't like bodybuilding, if you don't like Arnold, if you think he's a horrible human being because he had an affair and that was public. I really think the lessons you can learn by watching his documentary on Netflix are worth $100,000 in itself. His book is awesome called Be Useful. And what I like about there's two documentaries on Conor McGregor. One's on Amazon Prime. It's his old days in Ireland, living in his mom's house, talking about how he's going to be number one. And then there's McGregor Forever, the updated documentary. You probably watched The Last Dance, Michael Jordan documentary. You might have watched Breakpoint on tennis. Might have watched F1, Drive to Survive. Just got one episode left in the new season, sadly, myself. So finishing that up soon. But in Arnold, the very opening sentence of his documentary, which I'm sure was very carefully scripted and planned, was that throughout my life, I've been able to have a very clear vision of where I want to go and then just focus on that and work hard until it became true. And that's like me trying to be number one in family offices and now do it billionaires.com, looking up to people like this, some things that we did, but realize we're following some of these models. And so by reading it from a billionaire, someone like Arnold, makes you double down on what you already know works. It's kind of reminding you of how you became successful as an entrepreneur in the first place and ignore and filter out all the advice and noise that's coming in from other people. And so the other thing I learned from watching the sports documentaries, Arnold, is that when something knocks you down, It's very, very often if someone crashes a car in F1, if somebody gets off their A game in some way mentally, getting right back on it as fast as possible is what's super important. Dan Sullivan talks about that. Like, all right, be upset for 90 seconds and then get back to business. You know, protect your confidence and keep being productive. So I thought it'd be important to share. This is the tagline for his documentary. When I talk about the one pager, this is what it looks like. So I look at these people. We're looking at our investor club as a Amazon river, and then a whole bunch of tributaries or streams that feed into it. There's a stream of pro athletes, doctors and dentists, billionaires, other investor clubs, angel investors, et cetera. I then read over these one-liners every day. It's my mental programming. So when I start my day, I know my monthly goals, my quarterly goals, my annual goals, and then this is my mental programming. So like one of them is when you have an edge, exploit it and go big. Another one is expect excellence. There's all like mental programming. So I go out in the day and open my email inbox and say, nope, 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 yep, nope, nope, nope. And just very quickly with conviction, be reminded of what my goals are. Even though I wrote these down myself, they're not commandments for other people, but just so easy to be distracted every day by some new bright, shiny thing, some new big client proposal. You have to remember what you're already committed to. So only focus on what is potential. And most of the stuff we covered before, but I watched that interview with Mark Cuban recently, and he said, every single day, you need to wake up and ask yourself, what is the best use of my time? And it could be not what you wrote here. There's a reminder of what you committed to. But it turns out if you get diagnosed with cancer, or if someone offers to buy your company and it's serious and legitimate, like this will change, obviously, right? It's just every day you need to ask yourself what's most important. But you also need to review what you told yourself at the start of the month was most important in my experience. You need to get really good at defending your time. So I only take meetings with agendas. And then my trick is that I ask via email, oh, well, what do you want to talk about on the meeting? And they'll say like, oh, an investment pitch. Like, oh, cool. Can I look at the materials first? That way I'm going to get on the call. You don't have to tell me to marry ABC as well. Skip to page 7 where I have the questions. They'll send it to me. You're like, oh, sorry, we don't do startup mobile app investments in New Zealand. Or something, you know, like, or I'll just say, hey, here's some helpful resources. Let me help you. But I don't think we need to go through a full pitch of this. It's not really what we do personally. And that saves a ton of my time. Many times people say, oh, no, it can't be done over I can't be done over email. Like I have to explain it over the phone. We say, okay, well, it's just a pass for us because we're super busy. I look at a lot of stuff every year. But if we took every pitch verbally, we'd just go out of business listening to pitches all day. Also, what I found is that my default meeting times being set for 15 minutes can assess the tone for the meeting. My most valuable phone calls are 8 to 12 minutes long. People who set 1 hour time blocks for meetings by default are not super ultra successful people, usually, unless it's a board meeting, a intense negotiation, acquisition of something, big partnership. Like one of your most important meetings of the month, maybe, right? What I've also found, so when I get sent an agenda for a meeting, so I'll say, oh, I want to talk about valuation. I want to talk about the timing. I want to talk about these other 5 things. I will then write back in the email and address, because I can type really quickly, and I'll address in detail all of the 7 things and then bold number 4 and say, here's answers to everything that's on the agenda. Why don't we spend our time on the call just digging into number 4? Because that's where the beat is for me. Is there any of them that jump out to you guys as big problems? I think we're all on the same page. I don't think we need to verbally talk about all of these things that we can, in a 3-minute email, kill off 20 of a 30-minute phone call or much more, right? That saves me days of my life. Say no to almost everything. But most things are not going to be an exact fit. Have a focus. Have a clear position. Get better and better at saying no. And then what I found, this is something that I think almost nobody uses, I found, is that most meetings, like I said, I'll give you the agenda, you reply back over email, just dial in on the beat of it. Most meetings can be done via email or a text message. Those that can't, it's always more powerful to meet with an investor in person, by the way, obviously, right? If you're watching me on Zoom right now, you know, it wouldn't be the same. I can't even watch my own conferences on Zoom. I'll forget I'm watching a conference. I'm busy doing something else. And so we do things in person with important investors as often as we can. But 90% of meetings could be handled via text or email. It's just about whether you're going to work with that broker or whether something's going to happen or not. The 10% that are left, what I found is that most of those don't need to be done over a phone call either. It could just be an audio message. And so we send hundreds of audio messages per week over Slack and WhatsApp. And this is what I find super underused. It's like people are binary. They think, okay, meet in person, phone call, Zoom, or email. But an audio message is much, much better. You can hear the tone of voice. If you send me a question, I'll be 4 times smarter if I can actually think about it for 2 minutes. Whereas like off the hip, I have to come up with some like genius answer. I'm not going to be as smart. I'm not going to be as thoughtful. I might need to ask a team member, hey, do we have room on discussion panel number 5? Like, hey, can we set the men on that deal? Are we really full? Hey, are you open to those terms? Get the answer and then get back to them. Like, hey, we just met as a team. Here's your answer. This is what we could do for you. This is what we could offer. You can be more thoughtful. Hear the tone of voice. Build a real relationship. Keep in touch fluidly. It's way more efficient. By the time my competition has set up a Zoom call that people messed up the fact that Arizona's got the scariest time zone in the world, it's up to it. We've already traded 4 audio messages where it's like, oh yeah, I've got a time. We got 30 minutes next Tuesday, the start of next month. But you just had audio messages. You already have the whole thing solved that day, right? So audio messages on WhatsApp are really helpful. You can do audio messages on text message. It's a little bit more annoying. And my team is audio via Slack all the time. Definitely helps. If you work with a team on Slack and anything that's like sensitive or someone could take offense by it, so you can hear your tone of voice, you're not being a jerk about it. You just want to make sure that everything is good, right? So how many people here use audio messages a lot in your business right now? Awesome. That's good. Okay, so these are examples of goals that require extreme focus. If you're doing something really, really big, then you have to use the strategies we just talked about. Because if you don't, it's going to be hard. Like, do hard things. It's something that I forget who that quote is from, honestly, but one of my friends reminds me of it all the time. The things that are going to be transformative don't always have to be hard. It could just be laser focused, or it could be very specific or strategic. But many of them are hard, or at least take time, right? To interview 100 billionaires, that takes extreme focus. To read 240 books by billionaires, to scale your revenue 2x in the next year. If you want to record 1 video a day and do a daily podcast or YouTube show on a niche topic and put out 365 videos in 1 year, most other people don't want to do that. They don't even do 3 videos a year, right? So to even do a moderate amount might be massive for your business. But I challenge you to figure out how do you do something that's not moderate and do something extreme. And then once you've done that, other people want to work with you, not against you. And even if they do compete with you, you have such a moat around your business. You know, Goldman Sachs and Bloomberg build a family office event division to compete directly against ours. Whatever cubicle jockey they hire is going to get bored or cherry picked out by another firm in 3 to 5 years. And hopefully I'll still be here cranking away, right? The same with you because you're an entrepreneur. So those are some examples of what requires extreme focus.
What's the HLML?
What's that?
Workout for the
most. Oh, best health of my life. You know, sometimes I'd be like, oh, best shape of my life. You know, I'm not in college anymore. You know, so it's like you want to sleep well. You want to feel good. You also want to have emotional health, spiritual health, family health, relationship health, spousal health, et cetera. I was going to get to it a little bit later, but it doesn't really mean much for those around you. If you're an example of just financial success, and you're basically telling others like, hey, you have to, you know, use alcohol a bit, have no social life as an entrepreneur, sacrifice all vacations, work yourself to death to make the money. Okay, you should do that. You know, it's basically communicating with your life if you don't have a healthy life all around. You know, so that's something that is related to the Hawaii move and going on these fun trips with my family. It's like, what's the point otherwise? Just sitting on our computer, jamming away on keyboards and going on Zooms all day. It's like not sometimes not a full life picture. So some things I've done to give myself extreme focus is I went really deep with Brian Tracy and I got the audio summaries from 13 of his books, put it on an MP3 file. I listened to it on the way to work every day and back in Boston. And I can still to this day recite some of those with Dan Sullivan. For 1 year, I read every book Dan Sullivan ever wrote, and then I listened to every podcast episode that he ever put out, and then I joined Strategic Coach, and then I moved up the ladder in the Strategic Coach levels until I got to spend time one-on-one with Dan Sullivan and have him on my podcast and all that. So I have a little piece of Brian Tracy and a little piece of Dan Sullivan in my brain permanently. That's what I'm trying to do now with billionaires. Talked about that enough. Ogilvy was named one of the top 100 most influential people by Time Magazine for all the 1900s. He was a marketing advertising man. And he read everything on his competition. He knew everything cold. And he'd go in to pitch American Airlines or Procter & Gamble and he'd say, here's what everyone else is going to say. They've read all their stuff. It doesn't work nearly as well as what I'm about to tell you. This is what I do. And you ask them if they're even aware of this term or this strategy. I bet you they haven't even taken the work to read about what I'm doing. They haven't even considered that approach before. And he would win accounts at age 21 are at age 28, 29, 30. And he bought a leading advertising companies in New York City at a really young age because he read everything on his niche and he knew it cold. And nobody wants to do that. That takes hard work. Cuban found they worked in a computer software company out of college that no one read the manuals to computers they bought or the software, not even the owner of the computer software store. So whenever anyone came in, they would refer him to the 19-year-old college kid. They're like, oh yeah, that's on page 49. Didn't you read the manual? Everyone would be like, no. He'd be like, okay, you just do this and it's fixed. And so he was invaluable to the company, but it shocked him that no one even bothered to read the basics of the own business that they were in, right? So Warren Buffett reads 8 hours a day. Rubenstein, his goal is to read 300 books this year at age 74 while a billionaire serving on 10 different boards and all these different business entities, et cetera. They're voracious learners, but cutting out other things. I canceled my Wall Street Journal. I canceled my Apple News. People are like, oh yeah, aren't you afraid? You don't know about this or that going on. It's really important. And I hear about it from people multiple times. Right. And just like Dan Sullivan says, there's specialized knowledge or worthless knowledge. Most of us in the news, worthless. It's important to be educated when you vote. It's important to be educated on your health. It's important to be educated in your local community to some degree, for sure. But most of it is noise, right? So for me, this works for me. And having kind of a fast of other things. So I would ask you, what are 1 to 3 goals that deserve your extreme focus that are so exciting? They may take you 5 or 10 years to even do that goal, but it doesn't matter how much hard work it takes. If you ever got it done, then your whole life would change. That's like me with billionaires.com. I have no idea how long it's going to take until we can be the standout number one resource on billionaires globally. But if you ever get there, we'll make a few more billionaire friends and have like a halo effect around our whole business. So what would change your entire business if you could accomplish it? And what does your one pager look like with your monthly, quarterly, annual goals, your one-liner statement? What mental programming do you want to live on? If you shoot me an email, then I'll send you my one pager template. And you know, some of my one-liners I want to keep, some of my not. It's just richard@investorclub.com. But I'm happy to send that Word document to you because I get asked for that quite a lot. But oftentimes I share it and it's made me millions of dollars and people are like, I don't need that. You know, got my focus down, I guess. And I guess you're better at it than I am, but it costs nothing. And when Jeff Hoffman spoke at our event, created the airport check-in kiosk, he's a billionaire. He said a big part of his success was yellow sticky notes on his mirror every morning while he brushed his teeth. And that would remind him of what his top goals were every morning. So whatever system works for you, just to make it so you cannot forget your very top goals and you bump into them. That's really the main point. Okay, so a lot of this leads up to this idea that you should have the most fun year of your lives. Because I showed the billionaires and the super successful, they don't have patience for non-excellence around them. And they want to have exponential ideas, great team members, great partners, great business models. And it's not fun if you're working in a business that you don't like, you're not excited about, it's not a good fit for you. But also you should be doing fun things in your life, right? You should live in a place that's fun. You should work with people that are fun and positive, et cetera. And when I show this, people think, oh, okay, well, you should just go on vacation all the time and just not work. I work harder than anyone else that flies a first class next to me. I work harder than any one of my friends, except for my one friend who is like a black belt jiu-jitsu champion of Brazil and a couple other people that happen to be martial arts or former pro athletes, et cetera. So I work hard, but it's a fun, exciting adventure. I'm always doing a bunch of fun stuff and exponential things as much as I can. So looking at it is, why would you not want to have the most fun year of your life? And ever since I had that thought, I just have made that my goal, is to make each year the most fun year of my life and try to have that be communicated to my family, friends, team members. So this is a picture of one of my favorite places in the world, Bali. The reason I'm coming to Hawaii, it's like a close I can get to Bali with U.S. healthcare and police and much less bribery and stuff that goes on in other countries. But how do you have the most fun year of your life for you? It's going to be different for you. For you, it might be golfing 5 days a week is the most fun year of your life. It could have nothing to do with travel. Maybe you have it super dialed in at your company already. But you probably want your legacy to be that life is more about than just making money, right? It's like there's other things you're trying to get to, whether it's freedom, lowering stress, being able to help family members, maybe it's helping a foundation or your community, et cetera. And that's going to be unique to who you are. But what does it mean to have the most fun year of your life? And what could you commit to? This is very much connected to what is worth your extreme focus, what makes that warranted. For me, I quit two boards that paid me a ton of money per hour. But I was like spending, I was like 3 and 4 hour board calls helping other people build their businesses for like investing 1 or 2% equity in their company. So like, I forget this. I got 100% equity in my company. I'm going to build my own business, you know, and my time's worth more than that per hour. And it was just like, you know, they moved so slowly over things. It could have been handled mostly via email. I just find myself not fully engaged. And it was just like moving at a snail's pace. Cancel all the meetings I don't want to take. Only exciting exponential projects, fired stress from my team and my client list, put energy into what is working. There's a famous saying, I got this from Joe Polish, I'm not sure if you made it up, but he says that instead of the squeaky wheel gets the oil, which is like an old saying, he said the squeaky wheel gets replaced. It's like, instead of getting something negative attention, just get it out of your life. And it's just a better solution most of the time, right? Is the juice really worth the squeeze? Something else that he says quite often. Figure that out as much as you can. And then during COVID, I had the theme of just do it to grow, expand, acquire, and basically had the mindset of like, all right, we were hosting 28 live events a year. COVID hit, we go all virtual. So for 10 days there, I was like, all right, what am I supposed to do now? And everyone had to go virtual, of course. It was no big deal. But executing on the plan instead of waiting for that perfect moment and just going for it and structure the deal in a creative way and just get a lot done and make bold moves. So hopefully there's the 5 things you could do. Have the most fun year of your life. Because obviously life's not all about work. It's all about money. But also if your work is exciting, you're probably growing a more valuable company than putting up with bad partners and bad employees and a bad business model, right? So it goes very hand in hand. This is a strategy that probably has impacted my life more than anything else I've mentioned up to today, but it kind of builds on it. So in the hacker world, there's something called like a brute force attack where someone's going to guess your password like 100,000 times in a second. And sometimes they'll like take down a server and now your website goes down. But what they're trying to do is guess every possible combination of your password based off of all of your public history and anything they can find publicly. And if they get the combination right, then it unlocks your account and bad stuff happens for you and good stuff happens for them unless they get caught. So that's like a brute force attack. And then the idea of reciprocation is that if I do something good for you and I give you a book, you get a lot of value from it, maybe you help me back by mentioning it to somebody or something else down the road, right? If Jack adds a ton of value to you here, you're like, hey, Jack, how can I help you? Oh, let me toss over this deal to you and keep you in mind because it was perfect for what you said that you're doing. So reciprocation is it paying something back to someone. And what I found is that when you put out like a video on LinkedIn, helpful social media update, a resource, an infographic, an interview. For example, we just interviewed Mike Tyson on stage a couple of weeks ago. We can put that out on LinkedIn tomorrow, probably. That creates reciprocation at scale because then hundreds of people saw it. It wasn't just one person you added value to over coffee like an investor. So this idea is combining those two things. It is going into a niche area and trying to add value, penetrate the liquor sandbox, acquire choke points, do something big to have that sandbox be turf that you own with a number of combinations, constantly learning, figuring it out through hard work, but also becoming smarter. And you're doing it in a way that just adds value to people along the way. So you're doing it in a way that just builds more relationships, builds more momentum, get them a little bit smarter. You help people. You have to have a business model that allows you to make money while you're doing that, or you'll go out of business just right in thought leadership. That doesn't work. But this approach is really like when I was in high school, I wanted to work in the computer industry. So I cold called every computer company in the yellow pages because people actually used those in the 90s. And then one person gave me a job interview. He gave me a job. I learned how to build websites for Indian companies. When I got out of college, Oregon State University, everyone wanted to pay me $32,000 a year. It's not exactly Harvard University. And so I went and met with everybody in the Portland, Oregon Chamber of Commerce. One person was from Oregon State, had a great cup of coffee with her. And she said, oh, well, sorry, we can't hire you. You have 7 years of experience doing accounting or as a CPA to do Sarbanes-Oxley risk control consulting. And I said, hey, I'll work for free. We'll figure it out. If I'm horrible, fire me in the first hour, no hard feelings, but I know I can learn this stuff. So instead of $70 an hour, she paid me $40 an hour, first job out of school. And my first year working for her, I mean, I worked for free for about 10 days and then she started paying me, but she offered me $40 an hour. In my first year out of school, I made $100,000 a year, which was more than my professors that were teaching me the term before at Oregon State University. And so over and over again, this is the approach I've been taking. I did Sarbanes-Oxley risk consulting, paid for my MBA, very boring work. So I said, who's going to pay a 21-year-old kid $100,000 a year? Nobody. Unless it's based off of what I actually get done. So I said, okay, I need to work in commercial real estate and bring home deals or raise capital. I got two job offers for commercial real estate, but moved to Boston, studying psychology of influence and persuasion instead. And I did Sarbanes-Oxley 3 days a week, went to a capital raising company. He said, oh, you have to raise $100 million. We can't hire you. So, okay, I'll work for free 2 days a week. And then eventually it was 3 days a week for free. And then he felt bad and started paying me to do the capital raising work. And that's how I got into that industry. And then when I started the website, which was a blog on Blogspot, Blogger, basically, a platform that Google acquired eventually. Again, I started writing about what I was learning about family offices. I looked at all 500 keywords that people searched for online related to raising capital and family offices, had a spreadsheet, and I wrote two blog posts for every one of the top 500 keywords that people looked for. And I got on the front page of the Boston Globe at age 26. And I got 2,000, 3,000, 7,000 hits a day to the blog, and then the whole website took off. So I was really kind of forcing my way into a space by not taking the note and turn it into, well, let me make this zero risk for you. Invest our first deal with you at a small amount, 10K, 25K, put the first check in. We'll make it literally risk-free for you on your first deal. Then you're going to love us. And on the next deal, we might not always be able to do that. But come in and try it out. You're going to like us. We're going to take care of you. We're going to follow up with you, et cetera. And this approach is a little bit hard to explain without giving those examples. Basically, it's to be trying a whole bunch of stuff until someone gives you a shot and you just de-risk it completely and make it so there's like negative risk for that, like almost no risk at all. And that's been the secret to a lot of our success. But you can see it takes hard work. But if you're only doing that in a niche, which is exciting, the ironic thing is if you're willing to do whatever hard work it takes to dominate that little niche you're trying to be in, then you will do things that other people won't do who are just in it for a quick buck. No one writes a book, they're going to be out of the industry in 9 months. It might take you 9 months to write the book, edit it, get the visuals done and everything, right? So you want to do things others aren't willing to do, or they can't do, or not passionate enough to do, or they're not in it long-term enough to do. And then by showing that to other people, they'll believe in you more, and they would rather do business with you. So ironically, things go faster when you do things the hard, long way on a very focused niche than if you would have done it a shortcut way at the beginning. Right, it's like slow is smooth and smooth is fast. It's like the same approach here. Any questions on that before I move on? I'm just about done. I don't have time for questions, but at the end. But feel free to raise your hand if you have a question now. So, one of the most important takeaways here is that a lot of people don't have institutional quality materials. They don't think about that Venn diagram topic we talked about. I had never heard someone tell me you should have the most fun year of your life and somehow that's going to make you a bunch of money in your business. I've never met someone who's, you know, read the Millionaire book. So I'm doing these things out of my own selfish want for growth. This is also what's working for me, and I'm not competing against you. I highly doubt you invested in dental and medical practices at both locations and run an investor club. And if you do, we should talk. So there'll be lots of ways to work together, right? So we just share everything openly as we're learning. And I hope some of that came off as highly valuable for how you can apply it to what you're doing. But always looking for mental models you can take from this event here today, you can take from a book, and then apply it to what you're doing, even if someone's in a completely other industry, is what can lead to the most creative solutions sometimes. I used to read the Skywall magazine and the airplane, and you're sort of always like a top doctors in America, one pager. And it was obviously like surgeons now that are older that paid to be in there, promote their hand surgery or whatever it is. And then I didn't use that for 10 years. And then we took out a full page in Inc. magazine and said commercial real estate power players. And we had 10 real estate people paid for one slot for all 9 of them. And then we got the 10th slot for free. We got exposure to 2 million people in Inc. magazine. But it was using that idea a decade later. So some of the ideas you hear about today or from Jack, or from other people, you know, they're tools to use over time, even if you can't use them right away today. So there was not a huge barrage of questions. So I'll be surprised if there's more than one right now, but happy to take it for a bit here. And yeah, is it Harsh?
Yes, it does. Thanks for the engaging. So
sure.
I found the idea of the 2 points really interesting. So Let me give a few examples of like industries where you know, a practical example of like a transformative choke point idea.
Sure. So the question was, give examples of a transformative choke point idea. First of all, if you want to hear it directly from the source, the book's called Mastering the Rockefeller Habits by Vern Harnish. They might try to push you to the updated book called Scaling Up, but I like the old school one better. And it's got a full chapter on choke points. I also have a 70-minute long webinar on choke points. Send that over with lots of examples. But a tangible example would be the way I heard about this first was I was at a conference in Berlin, and this family, instead of buying mineral rights in Africa, they were getting the airplane surveying equipment, the seismic surveying equipment, which might cost them $500,000. And they would go to people that did not have the money to survey their land. They were cattle ranchers, they had 2,000 acres. They would go to them and say, hey, for just $10,000, instead of $500,000 cost to survey your land or $250,000, for $10,000, the price of the gas of the pilot, we'll survey your land. But then we split the upside on the royalties on minerals that we find, and we'll sell off those mineral rights to people. And so with one investment, they acquired what was the pain point for the cattle ranchers. And that one investment was highly more effective than if they had invested directly into the mineral rights. So that's one example. In the real estate space, it could be a joint venture with someone. It could be licensing a brand. Lots of people like to license their brand. So before this, I had coffee with someone, and they're looking to come in as CEO of an $800 million wealth management company. They want to grow it to $2 billion. And let's say they were from Austria, for example. Well, maybe they can go to Red Bull. Say, we want to license your brand, Red Bull Wealth Management, or something that's a little more conservative probably than a Red Bull brand. But like, you know, having that and having that exclusive agreement would be another example. Because once you have that in place, it's pretty hard to displace you unless you mess it up. So I hope that helps. Oftentimes, being first, largest, having the most thought leadership, the biggest YouTube channel, the first book on the topic, the only book on the topic, a domain name, those could all be things. But by definition, if you want to be the expert on the full stock market, good luck, because you're competing against Warren Buffett and Ray Dalio and all those people. Even if you want to be an expert on penny stocks, there's like hundreds of people competing for that. So you have to go down to the niche of like defense industry penny stocks. Something that's really niche, right? And then you could be number one. So the more crowded it is, the harder it is to break through, is my experience. Maybe any question in the middle or back? Yes.
Yeah. So all of the very interesting and smart nuggets you shared are mostly focused on the business side. But
okay,
there's different aspects. Obviously, you have three kids, health, family, and so on. How do you balance up? How do you recommend keeping the balance? Because it can be paid off very big.
Yeah.
When you spend your time on this stuff and compete against your other.
Right. Yeah, great question. So the question for the recording was like, you know, how do you balance, you know, health, spouse, other life, et cetera? For me, I set up a couple guardrails. One is, you know, I'm leaving, say, for Flagstaff, and I'll be skiing, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. But the only time I'll work while there is from, hey, 4 a.m. or so until 7 a.m. when the kids wake up, maybe while they're chewing on their cereal, finish off the last email, and then I don't work. And so last, when I had that picture of the most fun year of your life, it was a picture of Croatia. I hiked up this mountain where it connects to Bosnia and took that picture. And during those 60 days last summer, we went to Hawaii, New York, New Hampshire, Croatia, Italy, Oregon, and Hawaii. We traveled for 60 days straight while I ran my business. And every day, including Saturday, Sunday, I got up at 3:30 or 4 a.m. I was done working by 7:30 or 8 a.m. at the latest. And the rest of the day, it was fun. So by the time they're done having breakfast, done watching their cartoons, like I'm there with them. So I only do that when we're traveling, having fun. But that helps me keep on top of things. Also, the efficiency tools I provided are just hugely important. To say no to things you just don't want to do. Because your gut's telling you, this is a waste of time. What am I doing here, right? And then doing things on audio messages. And then, so on the weekends, I only work before my kids are awake. I don't do it at nighttime. My brain's more fresh in the morning time. Even though I used to be a night owl before kids. And then during the weekdays, I don't do dinners. We'll, when we have 1,000 person event, we might have a VIP dinner one night. So we have 4 of those a year. But the whole year, I don't do dinners. I stopped drinking alcohol 12 years ago to give me more energy. I don't need less energy in life. I don't need poison in my throat plus less energy. So, no, I don't care if other people drink around me and like railing against it, but it's just for me, I didn't need that. but not going to dinners in the evening time and starting my work early means I can be off work by 3 p.m. Already have 11 hours of work done. Like, that's enough. You know, if I work like 9 to 11 or 12 hours, that's enough. And then I can be there when the kids get home from school. So that those are some of the key parts about it. But I also believe that I was at a conference of 140 doctors and they paid $50,000 a year to be there. And I said, how many of you spent $50,000 on your health last year? And one doctor out of 140, and these people that work in healthcare, raised their hand. And I said, well, all of you prioritize your wealth over your health. But if you die, probably going to get taxed. Hopefully people around you are not happy with that. You're not happy with it. If you get hospitalized, you stop making as much money. Why wouldn't you invest at least as much in your health every year as your wealth? Because you're going to make more money if you live longer, if you're more energy, et cetera. People want to work with you more. If you are who they want to be when they grow up, then they want to work with you. So I have 28 ways I invest in my health. Simple things like I go to the hygienist to get a dental clean every 3 months. Most people don't once or twice a year, if at all. I get a full body MRI every 2 years. Insurance doesn't cover it. I just do it proactively so I don't die early because that's important to me. I get the safest cars on planet Earth you can buy, like a Model X or a Lincoln Navigator grandpa mobile, like I like to call it. So if anyone wants that Google Sheets, there's a Google spreadsheet, but we call it being ultra healthy, not just ultra wealthy. And we find that people love talking about that in our investor clubs. They don't expect it. They want to, people expect like a real estate deal. They're like, oh, we're going to manage your money and give you 9% cash flow. So we try to bring up the health part a lot because everyone knows they need to get it dialed in, but almost nobody does. And it's hard. So I hope that answers your question.
Alexan?
Yeah, cool. Yes.
How
many hours of sleep I get? Yeah, good question. On a bad night, the lowest I try to get is 6. I would love to get 7 every day of my life and never miss it. So for me, I found it's just going to bed early. I have no problem getting up and then getting at it. But going to bed early is really the skill set of like, all right, 9:30, you know, Drive to Survive needs to go off. Doesn't matter what just happened. I need to get to bed or whatever's going on. So it doesn't happen perfectly, but I don't aim for 8 hours, you know. So, but obviously, you know, they've shown it's like smoking a pack of cigarettes if you sleep less than 6 hours or even 6.5. Like, it's like exponentially worse if you sleep like 5 hours. So it's like horrible for you. Yeah, there's a book called Why We Sleep. That is amazing. It's one of the best books on health I've ever read. And it's like scientifically backed, but also practical to absorb. It just takes a couple hours to read. And Why We Sleep will convince you that you need to at least get 6.5, 7 is really the right healthy answer. I used to get like 4 hours, like 5, 7 years ago, and just found it made me too ragged to, and it's too reliant on caffeine and not good. I have time for one more question. And then like 3 or 4 minutes left here, I think.
Well, I have a comment.
Yes,
but how about on talking?
Just a quick question.
Yeah,
seminar that you guys brought. Are there actually other books or anything that you would recommend to supplement that?
Yeah, at familyoffices.com, we have a free book download there. Or you can email me at richard@investorclub.com. I'll send you the PDF versions of all of our books. You don't have to buy them if you want it. We've got a couple versions of the books. Back there, you know, billionaires.com, you can read all 40 billionaire, you know, interviews. And then I could send you the list of the 240 books. You know, but those would be the main resources that I would recommend that probably keep you really busy. We have 855 videos on our YouTube channel for Family Office Club. And we've got about 1,200 podcast episodes on our Family Office podcast if you're a podcast person. So our business model is really to try to help people out. And then sometime in the next 5 or 10 years, maybe there's a way to do business together, whether it's through a club or something else, and try to just plant a lot of seeds out there that are helpful. Yes, is it Kevin?
Oh, mine was just a comment, actually, since you didn't have questions. But, you know, I found myself listening to you and saying, God, I wish I'd heard this 20 years. Because a lot of the opportunities they've gotten is, you know, I'm a little older. And so these are opportunities I would miss. So for everybody in the room, you know, listen, don't look back and say, wow, I wish I could have done that. And a lot of what you said, absolutely true, especially with meetings, I sat hundreds of them, you know, no agenda, then, well, why is your time?
Yeah.
But this was probably the most productive couple of hours I think I've been in, probably 5.
I'm sorry it felt like a couple hours, but I appreciate such a big mess. Yeah. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And there's been one or two people that did not start their business career or business until they were 50, 55, and they became worth hundreds of millions or $1 billion. So, but yeah, I appreciate all the comments. Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it. Yes, Intel.
Just because you are addressing us as entrepreneurs, and it's really hard because you have kids and family alike and spouses that pull at you.
Right.
Do you have like a response when a loved one is like kind of detracting you from your responsibility of business? Right. Can you approach them to understand and lovingly?
Yeah, just the question was, what do you do if you have a loved one that's kind of detracting you from what you're trying to do in the business? Which can be really hard if it's someone that's like, you know, super close to you in the family, obviously. So one thing that helped me when I was in strategic coach was going to a couples connection retreat a couple of times. And it was the first time ever since being married that I wrote down my goals. My wife wrote down her goals. We looked at the business goals. We looked at the family unit's goals. And then we actually meshed up together. You might ask the passing, like, oh, do you set up any goals for this year? Or something like that. It might be it. Maybe if you're hardcore, your spouse actually wrote down some goals. Many times they don't even know what goals they want to have. They haven't even taken the time or have the self-care to set goals for themselves because they feel like, oh, well, I'm just trying to survive here as dad or as mom or just trying to survive the year running the business. So that helped my wife and I quite a lot. Obviously, sometimes loved ones can mean like a cousin or a brother or parents or something. And, you know, my family is super important to me, but I just couldn't live in Oregon because it was anti-business. The weather is kind of anti-life. So I got out of there and I just sat to be away from the family. So that was just a geographical distancing, but I just don't think people are meant to live in some places in the world. So that's why I'm here in Scottsdale. It's like, what's nice, right? So that might not completely help. Obviously there's intermediaries like for family offices or just anyone in business where, we can talk through a lot of that stuff. A lot of people don't want to hear the answer of like going to in some group setting to talk out and flush out a lot of it. But just saying it in a safe space where you can align everyone. Like this is why I'm doing it. It's for the family. Because sometimes it can feel like as a business owner, people don't realize how much you sacrifice for the family. Almost as if like you're doing it selfishly for yourself. And you come back after working hard all day. People act like maybe you're out playing golf or something. It's like I've been working like all day on this. You know, like it's for us. It's for the family, right? So I think that could be frustrating for entrepreneurs, no matter what's going on at their level. And this is just sometimes not being appreciated for how much work and sacrifice it took to get to where you are, right? So, yeah, not sure if that's like the most helpful answer, but happy to think about that more and try to keep in touch. I think we're out of time. Jack's walking up here, so yeah. Thank you.